time, at least the last year. So far, only one paper's come out of this, which was a letter that we put out a few months ago. And the long paper, I'll show you some results emerging from that and why it's been taking us so long. It's actually a really interesting statistical problem. So I'll get onto that. But that should be out by the end of May. You know, fingers crossed and all of that. Okay, so my collaborators on this project have been my my thesis advisor from Oxford, Pedro, and Dan Grin at the IAS, and Renee at Princeton. The only bit of jargon I'll be using here, my own abbreviation, is ULA for ultralight axion. This word, ULA, actually means creativity in a language in South America, according to one of my friends. So I think that's quite a cool little fact. Right, so start off with some motivation, and there's kind of there's a broad philosophical motivation for studying the axiverse and multiplicity in string theory. And in the paper String Axiverse by Ovanitaki et al., they quote Leibniz at the beginning, the principle of plentitude. This best of all possible worlds will contain all possibilities with our finite experience of eternity giving no reason to dispute nature's perfection. This is a kind of well-known saying of Leibniz. But after working on the, what they're trying to say is, there's all this wonderful stuff in the landscape, all these things that emerge, and isn't it great? We can just marvel at this. But after studying this for a long time, I kind of enjoyed this famous parody of Leibniz by Voltaire in Candide. So Pangloss is the old philosopher. He's the parody of Leibniz, and he says to Candide, "There is a concatenation of events in this best of all possible worlds. For if you have not been kicked out of the magnificent castle for love of Miss Cunegonde, if you had not come under the Inquisition, if you had not walked over America, if you had not stabbed the Baron, if you had not lost all your sheep from the fine country of El Dorado, why then you would not be here eating preserved citrons and pistachio nuts." And Candide replies, "All that is very well, but let us tend our garden." So he's saying, screw your philosophy, let's actually work, let's actually do something. So what's the doing physical motivation for studying the axions that I'm going to tell you about? So the underlying motivation is light fields in cosmology. Light fields tell us about cosmology because they do things at late times. If there are heavy fields, all you can know is that what the fraction of dark matter is. If dark matter is cold, you just know that it's there. But if it's light, you can learn things about it with cosmology because it has interesting behavior at late times. So I'm going to be showing you a lot of plots like this, where on the y-axis, I'll be putting the fraction of dark matter in axions, which is just the ratio of the contribution to the critical density axion to total dark matter. I'm going to be showing you a log plot of the mass. And what do we expect for fields in their mass? Well, fields have a quadratic potential, and they roll in it. They oscillate and they behave like matter. This is a really well-known result of, I think, Kolb from the early 80s. Probably Landau and Lifshitz before that, but who knows. So if you're oscillating, you're behaving like dark matter, you can just be all the dark matter. So you're just capped up at one down here. If fields slowly roll in their potentials, we know that they behave like a cosmological constant. So you can make up a large amount of the dark content of the universe. And somewhere in between, there's got to be a transition. Here you're coherent. Here you're effectively incoherent. You've got to roll. And when you roll, you've got some intermediate behavior and you're constrained by your effects on cosmology. So this is what you expect for light fields.
I'm confused. If it's behaving like a cosmological constant, how can it be all of the stuff?
Well, okay. No, what I mean is omega A over omega D can be greater than 1 then. Because omega D, it could still be non-zero omega C. Omega C. There's omega C here as well. That's why this can be less than 1. So if it's the cosmological constant, omega A over omega D can be 1, but that doesn't mean that it's all the dark matter. It means that it's all the cosmological constant. Do you see what I mean? This would be greater than 1. Twice as abundant.
Okay.
So this is kind of what you should expect for a distribution of light fields. Now, why the string motivation? Why the string axioverse? Why not just say, oh, there's some like fields around and let's constrain them? The string motivation is because if you know the fundamental theory that your particles are coming from, you know what they're doing in the early universe. So you can try and constrain early universe physics as well as late universe physics from the clustering. And that's the motivation for studying these guys in an inflationary context. But in general, for anything that you know the UV completion of, you can say what it's doing in the early universe. Or even not even UV completion, just that it's there, that it's a fundamental field. It's not some late time effective thing. Okay, so axions in string theory. How do axions emerge in string theory? Why is there a plentitude of them? And it's essentially because of the topological complexity of your Calabi-Yau compactifications. So we know that string theory gives us all these extra dimensions and we have to compactify them. And when you KK decompose form fields, you decompose a four-form field, you have harmonic contributions from the number of closed four cycles in the extra dimensions. And these guys remain massless. Axions are massless, so they're the KK zero modes. And they come from the number of harmonic forms. So here I'm just showing you what is a closed cycle. Here's a donut, here's a, you know, a 2D compactification, and there's two closed one cycles. Okay, so you get an axion for each closed cycle associated to your forms of a particular order.
I'm not sure where to object and how much you're going to say, though. I mean, this would be a property of some manifolds to be compacted by. But I don't know any reason to say that's always going to be true.
Well, as long as you have a non-trivial number of harmonic forms.
No, you can break lots of symmetries there.
Right, so we're going to talk about giving the masses later. But at the, you know.
Well, you just said it remained massless, so like I said, I wasn't sure.
And how much I'm going to discuss that on the next slide.
Okay.
So they remain massless in your like naive KK decomposition. Mm-hmm. And because there are many such closed cycles, you get many axions. And just as an example, I mean, a 6 torus isn't a Calabi-Yau manifold, but it's a nice simple example of a 6D compact space, and that has hundreds of four cycles approximately. So if you compactify type 2B string theory with the C4 form on a 6 torus, you would get a couple of dozen at least axions. So these guys, I said they're massless, but they can get potentials from many different things. In particular, I'm going to be interested in guys that get potentials from non-perturbative physics. So these are things like D-brains wrapping the cycles. And that means that your axions end up being pseudo-Goldstone bosons. So you can think of them originally as like the QCD axion as being the Goldstone boson of spontaneously broken global symmetry. So they're massless. But then the instantons tilt the hat and give you a preferred minimum. And for the case of a QCD axion, this is what restores strong CP symmetry. The QCD instanton corrections tilt the hat. Your Goldstone boson minimizes over here. These guys are not the QCD axion. They're other axions, but the idea is the same, and that's why they've got the same name. But they have their potentials for many different things. So what are these potentials? They've got to be periodic, because they've got to respect this their origin as complex field. So you can write down potentials like this. And they have two parameters. This field theta would not be canonically normalized. The field phi is canonically normalized. The energy scale associated to this is the decay constant. And there's the overall scale of the potential, lambda. If I expand this potential for small angles, it's going to be quadratic, and there's just going to be one parameter appearing, which is the mass. And it appears in this way. So I expand that. The mass is given by this ratio of the other two parameters. Both of these parameters, the decay constant and the overall energy scale, are determined by the moduli. And what do I mean by that? So S is the action due to non-perturbative physics on the cycle. And the decay constant should be given by roughly the Planck mass divided by this. So it's kind of relatively weakly dependent on this action. But the overall energy scale is set by some hard non-perturbative scale times the exponential of this action. And this action is basically the area or the volume of these cycles that you've compactified on, so it will have some modulus associated to it. Now, you know, we're all aware of the landscape. You've got many different vacua. You've got many different ways to stabilize your moduli. We shouldn't expect them all to be stabilized at the same place. So even small variations in the value of S for different axions are going to lead to exponential variations of the axion mass. So you expect the masses to be log distributed.
Okay, I'll make one more objection here, then I'll shut up about this. I would just say we now know, I mean, you could have said this story a year ago without objection, but this doesn't make any sense anymore.
There are examples of this by Ciccoli, by Ciccoli and Quevedo in large volume.
Yeah, no, that's not the, no, that this is the issue. The point is, like I said, I'll say this and then I'll shut up. If you're going to do these are all positive energy things, so this would yield an effective large cosmological constant in our dimensions. The way we get away with that...
No, zero.
The way we get away with that in normal things is we add a source of negative energy density to cancel that out. We normally say this where we're going to preserve a certain amount of supersymmetry, which is nice from a strength theory point of view if you could do it. But the only source of energy which we know how to do that with, or antipodes, we now know are unstable and not our... are not a Cauchy ingredient. So I would object on general grounds.
But axions aren't stabilized at positive cosmological constant. That potentially straight down with the cosine is stabilized at zero.
No, so you couldn't do the, so if you have this individual moduli, you can't do the whole story you just ran through, which has been the same story, but is now obsolete.
I'm not aware of that. I'm thinking of specifically large volume compactifications, and I believe that they're possible.
Yeah, I would strongly disagree.
Okay. So there's this log distribution of the masses, and if you think about what these light fields are going to do in cosmology, you can make a plot like this from Avanataki et al. I'm going to be interested in the light guys, where this type of transition is occurring on cosmologically interesting scales, and that is going to be down here, light fields and cosmology. Okay, the physics that's going to drive what we're looking at, it's going to be three basic things. I'm going to tell you about the background evolution of these fields, how their relative density is produced, and how that distinguishes them from something like a massive neutrino or a standard cold dark matter particle. I'm going to tell you about the perturbations, which introduce a k-dependent sound speed, which means we can detect these guys in the clustering. And I'm going to tell you about the initial conditions. And the first two are going to allow us to detect or constrain axions using cosmological observations. And the last one is going to allow us to say something about inflation from these late-time observations. So first of all, the production of the axions, which is by a vacuum misalignment mechanism. I'm going to have much simpler relations between the initial misalignment angle and the axion energy density than you might be used to seeing if you were thinking about QCD axions. And there's a reason for this. So the QCD axions have lots of complicated powers of the decay constant appearing in this relation. Decay constant appears to powers of like the 5/6 and things like this. And why is that? That's because of the temperature dependence of the mass. And while when the field begins oscillating, instead of scaling as -3, the mass is still varying, so it actually increases in its energy density as the mass increases. But if your field, even if it was a QCD axion, if it was as light as the guys I'm looking at, 10 to minus 18 EV, it reaches its zero temperature mass before it begins oscillating. So that effect of the change of the scaling doesn't see it, and as long as it's subdominant, you can just treat it as if it began with its zero temperature mass. So this is going to simplify a lot of the formulae, and this is always true for the ultralight axions. And even if you had the masses appearing at the QCD energy scale, but you might expect that they're getting their masses from string physics, the masses should be appearing at higher temperature anyway. So this is why the formulae are going to look simpler than if you were used to QCD axions. And the way this relative density appears is like this. The field remains frozen at early times and it begins oscillating. So on this energy density plot, at early times the field's a cosmological constant, then it begins oscillating and behaves like matter. So you can just work out from what's the initial value, what is the contribution to the energy density today. And this is with no thermal production, purely vacuum misalignment production, which you have to have. Anything else would be a kind of model-dependent statement.
Can I just interject something? This is the ultimate extreme end of the mass spectrum compared to Wimps.
Yes.
So you have to worry about, if you identify with dark matter, you have to fit data.
That's what I'm doing. That's why you get constrained like this.
So
I'm fitting data.
10 to the minus 18 electron volts. Mm-hmm. How do you get a mass profile that fits?
Well, it's because it's a non-thermal mass profile. So something with a mass 10 to the minus 18 EV, if it's not produced thermally, doesn't have a free streaming length associated to its thermal velocity. It only has these scale-dependent sound speeds that I'm going to introduce shortly. And the scale-dependent sound speed for something of a mass 10 to the minus 18 EV is very much less than a kiloparsec. So it's going to behave completely like dust on any cosmological scale. However, as you decrease the mass, the gene scale for these guys increases and crosses the threshold of galaxy scales, and that's when you start to be constrained.
I mean, you're never going to detect a particle in the laboratory at 10 to the minus 18.
Nope, it's a purely cosmological detection.
You never say never, but there's almost never.
There are some laboratory searches for things like this, but I'm not going to be concerned with them. These are completely cosmological searches.
All of this is inferred from gravity.
Yes.
Which is dangerous.
It's completely universal, though.
Because it's...
I don't think you're going to settle this point, Jim. I don't think you're going to settle this point.
Okay. So, the gravitational effect of these guys is that, as I said, they have this quantum pressure associated to them, which is due to the oscillation scale in the potential. And this has a dependence on the momentum, on k, on scale. So what I'm plotting here is the correlation function of galaxies, the power spectrum, as a function of scale. And on small scales, large k, these guys don't cluster. So in these plots, I've got all of the dark matter in an axion such that the mass suppresses clustering here. And as I decrease the fraction, the clustering increases. So the cold dark matter clusters on all scales, and the amount of clustering increases. As I decrease the mass of the axion, this scale of structure suppression moves out and out to larger and larger scales. And that's what we're going to use primarily to constrain them. So now on to the initial conditions. I've now told you about the first two parts of the physics here. What's the production mechanism for these axions? And what is their main effect on structure formation in the universe, which is a suppression of structure on scales that are determined by the mass, with lighter fields suppressing structure on larger scales.
Daddy, can I just ask, on the previous plot where the axion curve turns down, that's basically the Compton wavelength at the moment. Is the Compton wavelength at the moment when it?
It's the gene scale. It's related to the Compton wavelength.
And that's are they very different from one another?
I'll show the scalings. The Compton wavelength would just be 1 over the mass. The gene scale is 1 over the mass to the half power. Okay. But they're related. And it's just because you've got, in the Klein-Gordon equation, you've got a mass and you've got a k. And it's just this. It's just from the scaling between those two. And this, of course, is just a schematic plot to emphasize the effect. You know, if I put data on here, it would be like here.
You're including baryons.
Yeah, that's the baryon.
Those are my normal acoustic oscillations.
Yeah.
Those are the baryons.
Yeah.
They're
giving me my wiggles. Yeah. Okay, so initial conditions. So the usual initial conditions in cosmology are adiabatic curvature perturbations, but you can also have isocurvature perturbations. So adiabatic perturbations are this ratio between the number densities between two different particle species, one and two. An isocurvature perturbation is one for which the perturbation to the 0,0 component of the total energy momentum tensor is 0. And what you can say is you can just say this is one normal mode of the Einstein equations on superhorizon scales. Well, on all scales, but we can work out what it is on superhorizon scales. And this is just for each species, you're going to have another mode like this. You can just say, let's have every mode of initial conditions and constrain their contributions to cosmology. And people do this, and there's some really interesting work, really interesting degeneracies. But you might want to say, okay, rather than just saying, you know, let's have all the normal modes and constrain them, how are these modes actually excited? What's the physics behind them? What would a measurement of a certain amplitude of a certain mode tell us? So in single field inflation, you only excite this mode. But with axions, we're going to excite an isocurvature mode. So the constraint on the isocurvature amplitude is actually going to tell us something physical. It's not just going to be a constraint on what's the initial conditions. So these stable light fields, they're massless during inflation, so they have quantum fluctuations because they're a massless field in the sitter space, with the following variance. So I can work out what this means for the power spectrum of density perturbations in the axion. And because the background field phi zero is approximately frozen, it's this frozen by Hubble friction, it's like a cosmological constant, this is the approximate power spectrum. So it depends on the Hubble constant during inflation, but it also depends on the initial value of the field. And these fluctuations in general are created as long as the Peltier-Quinn symmetry is not restored by quantum fluctuations or thermal fluctuations. I'm going to be considering high FA axions, which is motivated by the string setup. So you can work out what the power spectrum of this is. It has an index. It's, as I'm just going to say, the adiabatic mode is going to be zero, so these are going to be uncorrelated fluctuations. So I'm just going to be able to add them together. Rather than with a curvaton, you'd have to do something more complicated to take into account the correlation. And the tensors and this index are going to be fixed completely by consistency with the amplitude that I choose, which I'm going to show shortly. They're fixed. That's both the amplitude, the tensors, and the tilt are all set by the inflationary slow roll parameter epsilon by consistency. So why do axions have an isocurvature perturbation? Because in the adiabatic mode, they're zero. So the adiabatic mode, that number density relation I wrote out just before, could be expressed in this way in terms of the equations of state relating to guys. When the axions are frozen, they have an approximate equation of state equal to -1. So if Wj is equal to -1, delta j is equal to 0. There's no adiabatic perturbation. In the adiabatic mode, they do cluster. And that's because at late times, they fall into the density perturbation set up by other components. But at early times, the superhorizon mode has zero perturbations.
It's not going to be exactly minus one, right? Is it?
Pardon?
It's not going to be exactly minus one. It's going to be a little bit above that.
Yeah, but I mean, at the time that we set our initial conditions, it's so close to -1. I mean, Hubble at initial times is so, so, so much bigger than 10 to the minus 18 EV. Like orders of magnitude bigger. So it's to a very good approximation, -1. We do include slow roll corrections to the adiabatic initial condition, actually. But it's close to -1 by many, many orders of magnitude.
It's such a plateau model. You maximize the energy, the potential. So how can you get W equal to -1?
What do you mean?
You can't. This is one of the problems with single field.
They're just frozen by Hubble friction. They're not on a plateau. They're in an m squared phi squared potential, close to the minimum.
Inflation.
They're not causing inflation.
This is not the inflaton.
This is not the inflaton.
Okay.
This is an additional field. This is a massless field orthogonal to the inflationary trajectory, and that's why it's got an isocurvature perturbation. Okay, so we parameterize the isocurvature fraction using this guy alpha. So alpha over 1 minus alpha is the ratio of the entropy perturbations, the curvature perturbations. I'll remind you that the curvature perturbations are very well measured and that they depend on the parameters of inflation in the following way: H inflation and epsilon. So I know the axion density power spectrum. I showed you it on the previous page. So I can tell you what alpha is in terms of these parameters. And it's this. It's approximately epsilon over the initial misalignment angle squared. The initial misalignment angle squared for vacuum misalignment, which I showed you earlier, it's basically some function of the relic density and the mass. So in my cosmological parameter estimation, I'm going to be Monte Carloing over this and this and this. So epsilon is fixed by consistency, as I said, and I know this function. We're actually going to determine it numerically to make sure everything's okay, but I can estimate this function.
Can you remind me how you're fixing epsilon?
I choose alpha, I choose omega ray, I choose ma, that fixes epsilon.
Oh, okay.
So we scan over alpha because that's the parameter that you actually measure that has a well-defined prior range between 0 and 1.
Okay.
So that's the phenomenological, we take alpha as the phenomenological parameter.
So sorry, I thought you were using some information from the spectral index or something. But
then no, but then we use this epsilon to fix the spectral index of the Isokevich perturbations and the tensors, as I said, by consistency.
Right, but not this, not the curvature.
No.
That's our mistake. So you've got another.
Yeah, yeah, the curvature index is still another free parameter.
Exactly.
That's effectively
the same. Could you say again the definition of epsilon? It's a floral parameter along the isotropic.
Along the inflation trajectory. Not along the Isokevich direction. So I can use these, and I can substitute in that value for the adiabatic amplitude, and I can tell you then what the energy scale of inflation is in terms of my model parameters. And it's given like this. And because I can approximate what phi initial is in terms of the relic density and the mass, I can tell you what H inflation is in terms of the relic density and the mass and the Isokevich refraction. That's given like this. And this is if the fields begin oscillating in the matter era or in the radiation era. Okay, and you want to compare this number to the kind of constraints on the energy scale of inflation that, say, Planck get. So from a constraint on the Isokevich refraction, like this, that Planck get, the number I've taken here is a WMAP number, and I'll explain why shortly. With some assumptions, the Isokevich constraints on axions from Planck, say, the energy scale of inflation has to be very, very small. But the constraint from tensors says the energy scale of inflation has to be less than a much larger number. So you just take these two and you say, well, this constraint implies the tensors are very, very, very much less than 0.11. But let's look at what assumptions went into this in a little bit more detail. So this is covered in really good detail in the appendix of WMAP 5. So they take the relic abundance for a QCD axion, which depends on the decay constant, the initial misalignment angle, and some factor for entropy production that you might want to use to dilute the relic density. They measure this, and this is better than the comparison to Planck because this includes BaO and H0 as well as the ECMB. And they predict, and their constraint for alpha, using the QCD formulae, they predict R in terms of alpha, 10 to the minus 12, and these factors. Then, to get that direct constraint on H inflation, they assume that the axions make up all of the dark matter, which you can't determine using cosmology alone if it's a QCD axion, because it's indistinguishable from any other type of cold dark matter. And they assume that there's no entropy production. And then that gives you a direct constraint on, in this case, the potential energy during inflation, like that. And it's this very small number here that led people like Patrick Fox a few years ago and also Paul Steinhardt and Katie Mack to say that any observation of primordial tensors would rule out a string QCD axion as dark matter. Because either they would have to be diluted out of existence, so they're not a significant part of the dark matter, or you couldn't have an observable amount of tensors without violating the Isokevich bound.
What does the string have to do with it?
The string bit is that FA is not small. So you could make FA smaller and get around this.
Well, that makes R even smaller.
How did they get this?
Bigger. You can make FA bigger.
You can make
I guess so. They go into a bit. I think it's
You can't get a transplanckian.
If FA was low, you would never produce Isokevich modes. Because if FA was low, it was lower than H inflation. You'd break the Petrequin symmetry after inflation and you'd never produce Isokevich modes. You'd have some kind of domain wall problem maybe, but the Isokevich constraint wouldn't apply for low FA. Because you only break the Petrequin symmetry after inflation. Okay, but when I take my formulae for an ultralight axion, that statement that you can't have an axion, it's not going to be a QCD axion, that you can't have tensors and Isokevich and an axion dark matter is no longer going to hold. And it looks like this. So what I plot here, these two blue contours, span the region of parameter space in omega, in fraction of dark matter in axions versus log mass, where tensors are in the range 0.01 are 0.1. So they pass the current bound, but they're observable in future. This is like, you know, some ultimate all sky temperature and polarization CMB experiment limit of the measurement for R. And then I also put alpha in the range ultimate forecast for cosmology allowed by current constraints. And you span this region in parameter space. So in all of this region, you're allowed to have observable tensors and observable isocurvature for axions. That's a good thing. You've got two things that measure the energy scale of inflation. You can compare them to one another if you were to measure them. But there's a constraint. There's this U-shaped constraint. And the U-shaped constraint here is taken from Amendel and Barbieri. I'm going to be comparing it to our work shortly. They use a grid-based likelihood that is not optimal. But there's this U-shaped constraint on the parameter space. So you're left with only two more regions where this check can be done. I should point out that this region, at high fraction and high mass, is still interesting. Because in this region, you can probe low-scale inflation. And you can probe low-scale inflation in a unique way because you're actually constraining the fraction that these guys can make up of the dark matter, which you can't do for a QCD axion. So you can still break one of the important degeneracies in using axions to measure the energy scale of inflation. But you can't get the tensors as well. Down here, you can get the tensors. And I'm going to discuss fine-tuning on this plot shortly. So there's two sweet spots, one where you're behaving like dark energy and one where you're behaving like some kind of effectively hot component of the dark matter, effectively warm component. That U-shaped plot's going to get better in the future. We've done some forecasts for Weave and Euclid, which are galaxy surveys, and the fraction and axions. You can start getting constraints on order of the percent level from future galaxy redshift surveys. So you can really start beating down that plot across a large range of masses because you measure a large range of scales.
And those constraints are all coming from the basic suppression of small-scale power?
So this is all coming from the suppression of small-scale power in the adiabatic mode. No one's combined this with isocurvature before. Okay, so I've got about 20 minutes left, so I'm just going to spend a little bit of time on the methodology. So studying this, scanning that range of parameter space is quite hard because I'm spanning many orders of magnitude in mass, which means I'm spanning many orders of magnitude in time scale. I'm solving the Boltzmann equations numerically, so there's a separation of scales. The mass is very much larger than the Hubble scale, which is the time scale. So the oscillations, this is the background Klein-Gordon equation. When the mass is very much bigger than Hubble, in conformal time, the amplitude of the oscillations increases. I mean, not the amplitude, sorry, the frequency of the oscillations increases. So this becomes harder and harder and harder to solve numerically and takes more and more and more time. So if I just want to put the Klein-Gordon equation into my Boltzmann solver and solve it by brute force, I can go only up to masses, and I've done this. So do trust me. I can go up to masses about here. And even then, it takes on a laptop order half an hour to do one run. We're going to be doing Monte Carlos on this. We're going to be doing tens of thousands of runs. So this just isn't viable. Solving it in that way is not viable if I want to go out all the way over here. It also even gets worse if you try and have these guys making up a large fraction above about 10%. You start introducing oscillations into the Hubble rate as well, and then your integrator just goes crazy. So we're going to have to be a bit more clever. What we do is we use an effective fluid formalism. So we compute the background quantities, the adiabatic sound speed, adiabatic not referring to the perturbations, it's just a nomenclature thing, and the background density. We do compute directly solving this, because you only have to do this once in each call of your Boltzmann integrator. So we solve the background density completely, and that's fine. And then we substitute that in to some effective fluid equations. And at early times, I can solve the perturbed Klein-Gordon equation. I can rewrite that exactly as the equation of motion for an overdensity and a velocity determined by the adiabatic sound speed, which I've just computed for the background. So that's just a remapping of the parameters. And it's exact. So early times, I solve an effective fluid that's exact. Then at late times, what I do is I make a WKB approximation. So I average out analytically the oscillations in the background, and I treat the background as a W equals zero dust fluid. And I solve directly in the synchronous gauge for the sound speed. Now, the sound speed is one in the rest frame of the scalar field, but this is in the synchronous gauge, so it's not one. And in fact, it's this k-dependent sound speed that induces the structure suppression that I talked about. At small k, which is large scales, it has a quadratic k-dependence, and it goes to zero. Zero sound speed in the synchronous gauge corresponds to cold dark matter. This is why these guys look like cold dark matter if the mass is large and on large scales. But on large k, small scales, the sound speed goes to one, so they don't cluster. And so at late times, I use this in the same fluid equations. And it looks like this schematically. So these are the, it just looks like this. These are the equations of motion for the heat flux and the overdensity. So you can see at early times, everything is determined by Cr, and I solve this exactly for the slow roll background. You wouldn't have to do this if you were just in the adiabatic mode. In the adiabatic mode, these are very close to zero, and it'd be fine to just set them to zero. But in the isocurvature mode, this is driving the density perturbations. So setting its time derivative to zero is not good enough. You have to follow slow roll. But then at late times, we take the average of W to zero. We take the average of the sound speed. And in WKB, it now looks like this. So now this guy's smooth, and these guys don't oscillate. So this makes things very fast. So now I can scan the entire mass range. Every run takes the same speed because I always cut them off before oscillations come in. And runs take seconds, and I can go all the way up to here. So it's a vast, vast improvement on the speed, and you don't really lose any accuracy. And we've done various comparisons between the full scalar field treatment and this. So because these axions aren't behaving like cold dark matter, I have to normalize my isocurvature perturbations in a slightly different way. And this is, it's just like you can't normalize the neutrino density isocurvature in the same way as the cold dark matter density isocurvature. So if these guys were part of the dark matter, or even just part of the matter, I could take a normalization where the initial density perturbation was just set to one in all of the matter. So Planck, for example, constrained a combination of total matter isocurvature, including baryons and cold dark matter. In a given model, you can then extract the baryon component because you know omega baryon, and it's very well constrained. But because our guys aren't behaving like cold dark matter, they need their own normalization. So we call this alpha A. So alpha A is related to alpha CDM if you were just treating the axions as cold dark matter by this factor. And you can see they're equal if the axions are all the dark matter. So this alpha A is the parameter that we Monte Carlo over. So now we've developed all this wonderful machinery, and we can finally start doing some computations of observables and constraints. So we can compute the TT power spectrum. So here's the adiabatic power spectrum for reference. Here is an isocurvature component. If you had, I think it's like alpha of 0.5 or something. If you had just one type of dark matter and you had an alpha of 0.5, this is isocurvature spectrum. And what you do, of course, is you constrain how much of the total can be comprised of this. That's what you're constraining. So now, if I introduce 1% of the dark matter in a light axion, my normalization difference brings me down to here by a factor of 0.01 squared, 10 to the minus 4. But the spectrum looks exactly the same for a heavy axion. If I just shifted this up, these would lie on top of each other. But as I start decreasing the axion mass, the spectrum no longer looks different. So it's not just a trivial scaling. So alpha A is going to be less well constrained than alpha CDM if you have lower omega A, just like this. So that's just like the neutrino density isocurvature mode. Alpha is allowed to be bigger than 5%, which is the CDM one, because it's scaled down by its density. But we've actually got a different shape of the spectrum as well. The spectrum displays the same suppression of power for light guys, And what this means is that even if these guys are making up large fractions, so this is up here, you're losing the, you're losing power, so you're losing information. So we did a simple estimation of what the effect of this might be on the constraint, on the estimates I showed you before. And you basically just lose constraining power on any guy where you're suppressing power in the plateau. Because most of the constraining power for an isocurvature mode comes from the plateau, because they fall off faster than the adiabatic mode. So all your constraining power comes from the effect of this plateau. Changing the peak structure doesn't really matter if you're locked to being close to scale invariant or a red tilt. When people use the peak structure in isocurvature to constrain it, because they're allowing a blue tilt. As I said, we're fixing our tilt by consistency because we've got a model. So you're fixed to be close to scale invariant. So the peak structure doesn't matter. You're only getting information from the plateau. And so you basically lose constraining power to the light guys. So now, only in this region would you have an observable value of isocurvature and tensors. So already we think there's only going to be this interesting region where you can do both left. Although again, I stress, this is still an interesting place to be. Okay. How might isocurvature constraints improve with polarization measurements? So adding in an isocurvature fraction effectively reduces your adiabatic amplitude. So you have less adiabatic power. And because, and the isocurvature doesn't contribute very strongly to polarization. So as I'm introducing isocurvature, I'm effectively reducing the amplitude of the adiabatic polarization. So here I'm increasing alpha from 1% to 50%. And you can see the drop in the adiabatic amplitude. So at the level of current measurements with things like quad, you don't really have a very strong constraining power between these different models of isocurvature. But you know, when we start getting better polarization measurements, when Planck polarization comes out, ACTPOL is going online soon. They're in Chile at the moment. Isocurvature is also going to start constraining alpha, so you're going to be able to, so you're going to improve your constraints further from just it, from just adiabatic mode, from just the temperature. Okay. We also look at CMB lensing. So these guys, the data points on here act because in the analysis I'm going to show you very shortly, we only use ACT and WMAP, and that's simply because it's a hard statistical problem, and we're training our machinery on data and likelihoods that we understand. These are the ACT data points. You can see an axion making up all of the dark matter suppresses. It's exactly the same as I showed you in the matter power spectrum. So, like, you know, this guy is just not going to be right, is he? But Lenzing is important because Lenzing is involved in this kind of possible discrepancy in Planck between CMB and cluster estimates of sigma 8 and, you know, the possible variation of the Lenzing amplitude. When you include Lenzing, the neutrino mass constraints change for exactly this kind of reason. So Lenzing is going to be important. Okay, 10 minutes or so, and I'm going to get on to the results. So now I've kind of gone through a whole bunch of observables, and I've gone through, you know, a whole setup of machinery, and but now we actually want to do some constraints. The constraints I showed you earlier on that rough plot were done, as I said, using a grid-based likelihood on just the two parameters. It's going to have missed a lot of the degeneracies, and it was done in 2005 with like WMAP 1 data or something. So data has got a lot better since then. And we want to do a proper analysis. We want to do Monte Carlo over all the parameters, get a proper estimation. So we impose these priors. This is the log prior, as I said, motivated by the exponential in the mass. We're going to take a uniform prior on the axion energy density. And that's because that's the same prior that you use for cold dark matter in cosmology usually. Now, there is another possible prior that you can use on this, and that's because if I assume a uniform distribution of misalignment angles, it will give you a different prior on the energy density. So we are going to compare those two priors, and if when you're not strongly constrained, you should be prior dependent, and this should make a difference. Like a uniform prior on alpha, as WMAP do. This might correspond to some wacky prior on epsilon, but like you know, unless you have a UV completion that gives you a prediction for what the prior and epsilon should be in the multiverse, then this is as reasonable as any other. Yes. So we're assuming kind of phenomenological prior in the energy density rather than a prior on the initial displacements of the field. Okay? As I said, we can compare those two priors. So this is our flat prior in omega A, and the falling prior, if you took a flat prior on the field, would look like this. So you're going to cut yourself off at large fractions. And that shouldn't matter when you're data-driven, but when you're prior-driven in these regions, it will make a difference, and we're exploring the different priors. So I said I'm going to discuss fine-tuning. So this is the data point from a chain run with WMAP and ACT lensing. So this is the so these are data points here kind of roughly map onto likelihood. But I'm more showing you what is the actual misalignment angle here, phi over m Planck. So if the decay constant was Planckian, phi could go all the way up to the Planck scale. And you can see all of the points that we explore are covered with sub-Planckian values of phi. So if the decay constant can go up to the Planck scale, we can cover the entire space. We don't need to invoke any other kind of crazy physics like monodromy or something to get the high relic densities. However, if you said the decay constant is at the gut scale, a couple of orders of magnitude below the Planck scale, this contour here, in fact, I thought I'd put some labels on these. Are they just not appearing? They are. There you go. This would be order one misalignment for a gut scale decay constant. So you could only live in that region. But that's exactly the interesting region I pointed out before. So our interesting region is still interesting, even if you've got a sub-Planckian decay constant. You can go up to pi on misalignment angle, so you could even start approaching this line here. So you can cover quite a lot of the parameter space for the interesting masses. And these are also interesting in terms of galaxy formation. And this bump here, you're just seeing the first part, the first oscillation of the field, exactly shown out in the chains. But this is a hard problem for MCMC. Why is this not efficiently sampled, this space in a Monte Carlo Markov chain? Why is that? It's because you've got multiple degeneracy directions. So here is a constraint on omega A versus omega C. So there's a strong degeneracy, a one-to-one degeneracy here. And that corresponds to when you're heavy, you're completely degenerate with the dark matter. But when you're light, you're degenerate with the dark energy. So your covariance matrix completely turns over. So in those two wings of that bimodal distribution, you have a completely different covariance matrix. So we've looked at things like imposing a varying covariance matrix in the different regions, but then you have to worry that you're breaking detailed balance and that your process might no longer be Markovian. So we're looking into different ways of tweaking an MCMC to make this run better. So for example, if you set one type of covariance matrix, you get locked in one wing of the distribution, and you don't sample the belly very well. And in general, because your MCMC learns the covariance matrix, the chains tend to get stuck in one wing or the other. So convergence is very bad. What we've done, though, is we've run, say, about 12 chains, starting in all different regions, and then take sets of those chains that cover the entire space and ask about convergence between those sets of chains. And then the convergence can be good, but it still took our MCMC on Cynet, like, you know, 2 weeks to run to get any kind of good convergence. So MCMC is not very good for this problem. So we've moved on to nested sampling. And nested sampling is a bit different. I'm just going to read from my notes here, because Renee told me about nested sampling. And it moves more systematically. It starts in a bunch of, it basically does what we were saying to do for the MCMC by hand. It starts in a bunch of random places, but then in each random place that it starts, it learns about the likelihood and steps in that way, and steps in that region more systematically. It's a different type of sampling. And our nested sampling chains converged really quickly. Well, they don't converge, they have their own criterion for stopping. And so we compared this multi-nest way of looking at things with MCMC. So in purple, I've got MCMC. And in gray, I've got multi-nest. And they agree kind of a bit, but we're still testing multi-nest, and we're testing it on Lambda CDM. We don't really understand it yet. So this is one of the things that's holding us back. We don't understand our nested sampling versus our MCMC yet. Once nested sampling works, we should just be able to like hammer it home. And for comparison, I've got the CMB-only constraint from the 2005 Amendola and Barbieri work living on top of there. So everything's kind of roughly consistent. They've got some funny shapes, but again, that's because they did a grid-based likelihood.
Yeah, I guess, what am I thinking about wrong? What, I mean, if you just took your prior so that it only allowed one of those regions, you ran and got your chains, and then you took the prior to have a sharp cutoff and some intermediate value there in the well, and then you did the run with the complementary prior that only allows the region above that.
Yeah.
Then
you concatenate the two chains.
Well, in other words, you get
and that's what we've done.
Okay.
So that's what this MCMC run says. We've done that. We've taken three different regions, run like four chains in each region, concatenated the chains, tested for convergence on that. Gelman-Rubin is kind of okay.
Still concatenating, you're basically asking, what is the likelihood of this exclusive or that? And the likelihood is just, in that case, the sum of the two likelihoods you get in either case.
I'm not an expert on the mechanics of this. But I know that when we're doing these kind of running multiple chains things, it's still not very optimal, and it's not very slow. And I mean, it is very slow. So we don't quite know how much to... We're using that as kind of our acid test in it, but it just took too long because we want to do a bunch of different models. So what we want to do is we want to take an MCMC that we have run like this and that we trust that took a long time, and hammer multi-nest until multi-nest agrees with it, or we know that multi-nest is right, is more right than that, and then run all of our models in multi-nest. So like this difference here, it could be because the MCMC, even when you kind of constrain it to live here, it still doesn't want to sample this region. It still falls out. So this is kind of undersampled. So we don't know whether this difference is because multi-nest is right, or if this difference is because we still don't understand how multi-nest is working. And so this is an interesting statistical problem, and that's why we're spending a long time doing this properly, because you want to sample a space where your covariance matrix is evolving. Just a couple more slides. One is, now I'm showing a few more points just to demonstrate, we're going to use large-scale structure constraints and CMB constraints. So this is, again, just showing the points from a chain. The black is the CMB, and the orange is SDSSP of K with some priors on the parameters that doesn't constrain. And what you're seeing is that these are complementary probes. So the CMB is more sensitive to low masses. That's because they're beginning to oscillate kind of at recombination, so they're affecting recombination physics. If you're making up a large fraction of the dark matter at 10 to the minus 28 eV, you're oscillating at recombination and you mess with recombination, basically. Whereas the large-scale structure, the Sloan power spectrum, only measures things on the smaller side of the equality scale, so it's much more sensitive to the higher masses. So these two shapes of the user are just showing you that these are complementary probes.
So it's the effect strain of recombination that's doing it, not the isocurvature.
This is an adiabatic run, just showing you that these are complementary observables for adiabatic. So we're still training parts of the chain. So the chains that I'm showing you here are still being trained on adiabatic.
What do you mean by how do you get adiabatic
information? Well, I said the initial overdensity in axions is zero in adiabatic, but once they start oscillating, then they just fall into the into the perturbation of everything else. And you can show that as you increase the mass, the initial conditions asymptote to one another.
Okay, so you're not using isocurvature constraints at all here?
Not in this chain. I'm about to show you the isocurvature constraints. But this is just demonstrating in a simple case of adiabatic.
So this is black, hot, dark, matter, basically.
Warm.
Well, warm. Depending on the mass.
Yes, depending on the mass, it's like that. But the main difference is hot and warm dark matter are more strongly constrained by the CMB because at early times they're behaving like radiation, so they're contributing strongly to the energy density. Whereas axions are cosmological constant at early times, so they're very subdominant in the radiation era. So in the clustering, it's exactly analogous to hot and warm dark matter. The shapes are ever so slightly different in the transfer function, but in the CMB it's very different. And actually the chains look the same for isocurvature here, but you could think of this as just marginalized over the isocurvature amplitude. Or we're also doing plot fluid where we color these points by what is isocurvature amplitude. So you see where the degeneracies are, but we're still waiting on the spots. But the chains would look essentially the same if I marginalized over alpha. And so in pretty much closing, this is kind of what our constraints look like at the moment. So the constraints on the cold dark matter density peaks around what you should expect it to be, but likelihood goes to zero, and that's just because there's this one-to-one degeneracy with the axions at high mass. So this is good, this is showing us what we expect. The axions peak at zero, but they carry on for quite some time, making up a portion of the dark matter where they're degenerate. The mass has peaks at low mass here and high mass on the other side. That's just the fact that you've got bimodality. And one nice thing that you're seeing here is what I told you about being able to simultaneously measure R and alpha is being borne out in the constraints. So here's alpha, constrained at about the 5% level by the CMB alone. That's what we should expect. And the marginalized constraint on R inferred from that is on the scale of a few percent. Now, if I ran with a QCD axion and I showed you what is the marginalized constraint on R for this profile of alpha, this axis would have a factor of 10 to the minus 12 on it. So it's the scale of the axis which is important for R. This is just taken from marginalizing over this and this on this. And it's still at the level of a few percent, the marginalized over all the other constraints. So you would be allowed very much to have a tensor amplitude of a few percent that could be observed directly in B modes.
So that's not a few percent, that's 0.2%.
That's 0.2%.
On that one, is it? Oh yeah, that's a slightly different scale. Okay, there was another chain where this was slightly larger. I have read that wrong. That's the marginalized, that is the marginalized constraint being very small. But, okay, you're right, I read my axes wrong. But say I were to fix a given mass, instead of marginalizing, slicing over a fixed mass, there would be regions of the parameter space where that is larger. So you can think of that as, say in these chains, only down here is R gonna be a few percent. Up here, R is going to be that one, 0.2%, and you know most of your likelihood's up here. So you still marginalize it down, but if we were to color the points, there would still be the regions where it's a few percent.
So did you look at that other prior that you were suggesting?
The other prior on the density? We haven't got that far yet. As I said, we're still testing our multi-nest and MCMC algorithms. Okay, preliminary results, and that's it. This is my outlook. So the results should be around in the end of May. Then we're going to work on Planck data. The likelihood's apparently a bit of a mess to modify. We're interested possibly in how the distance indicators have come into this. So very quickly, this is the Union supernova data. This is the Planck best fitting lambda CDM cosmology and an axion low mass cosmology. So say we picked like to be about here. We just picked a point from our chains that's allowed. The distance indicator that it's slightly lower And so these could start. This could be a useful inclusion, but CMB lensing might have taken care of this for us already. We're going to test including the distance indicators. So Ben Vandelt suggested that we should do this, and I think it's quite interesting. We're also going to run some models where we set explicitly to have no dark matter at all, just axions, no cold dark matter at all, just axions. And then, of course, you're only going to be allowed in the high mass region because you've got to have some dark matter. But we want to look for if there's a preferred scale. If there's a particular mass that is much more likely than the others, then we'd be seeing a preferred scale in the data. So that's one way to test for that. As you said, it's kind of also similar to warm dark matter. Might be useful for galaxy formation if you think there's cusp core problems or missing satellite problems or anything like this. So I'm kind of looking into that at the moment as distinct from warm dark matter, because the shapes of the profiles are quite important. Okay, and finally, in summary, light axions have interesting effects on cosmology because they suppress structure formation. And this allows you to constrain their density fraction using cosmology, which you can't do for a QCD action because it just looks like cold dark matter. And when this happens, with a light axion, you're also allowed to have simultaneously observable isocurvature and tensors. But the details of how this works out depends on having a reliable machinery to compute the observables. Thanks.
I just said before people run off that they're we'll have dinner in the bistro at 7 tonight. Postdocs, grad students, free.
Getting back to experimental physics, there are lots of inflation models. There are non-inflation models, there are dark matter models, non-dark matter models, etc., out in the market. So how do you can't detect this action in the lab.
No, but you can detect them using cosmology.
Obviously. So what particular experiment verifies or falsifies this model compared to others?
Exactly this constraint. From the large-scale structure. So, I mean, you never falsify something completely because you can never say, you know, is a parameter zero or just very close to zero. But if it just looked like this, the constraint, and this was at like 10 to the minus 3, you'd say, this is not an interesting model anymore.
I think John is asking, if you detect it, how do you confirm
it? If you detect it, you would see, a peak in that likelihood distribution. You would see, say there was just one axion, a fixed fraction, this would all drop away and you just go, oh, there we go about that.
So there's no unique parameter prediction from your voice. It's just adjusted parameters.
Yeah, but that's because you've got that's what happens in spontaneous symmetry breaker. The vacuum misalignment is not predicted by the theory. That happens for anything with spontaneous symmetry breaking.
This is a disease with this whole subject.
You mean you're having three parameters? Is that what you said?
Well, the fact that I can't actually nail down an experiment which tells me that Smith's model is better than Jones or whoever.
But the point with the light axions is, with the heavier axions, yeah, this is true, you just can't say. But with the light axions, you can at least make this statement. You can at least say they're not there. And if they were there, you could detect them.
Perhaps now is a good time to wrap up and move on to lunch. I think we can carry on this discussion later on. Thank you very much.